Who dares wins. This is the motto of the Australian Special Air Service Regiment, one of the world's most elite counterterrorist units. For this episode, we're going to play part two of the conversation that we had with Special Air Service Regiment Trooper and recipient of the Victoria Cross, Mark Donaldson. The Victoria Cross is the highest award that can be awarded to a soldier in combat for an Australian. Mark talks about running operations with the Army Special Forces Green Berets in Afghanistan, and then he talks about the operation for which he was awarded the Victoria Cross. For this conversation, I was on with my co-host, Chantel Taylor. My name is John Hendricks. This is this week's Global Recon Podcast.
So I guess probably just to give it some context, you know, 2008 we got a lot more kinetic and targeted, and that led us to we'd have one of those funny trips where it was a bit of like tit for tat, you know, a bit more engagement, a bit more contact with the bad guys, and we'd lost one of our guys through an IED strike, and you know, a couple of guys wounded and some other things, and I'd been blown up in an IED a couple of weeks before this, 3 weeks before this as well. And we went, we'd sort of cleared out that sort of top guy from our province anyway. And it was the usual thing, right, the poison chalice. So the next guy was coming in and we wanted to get on top of that quickly, and it led us up to this area of Oruzgan, which was kind of, as John was talking about before, it was under control of the ODA teams. There was an awesome team up there out of FOB Anaconda at Kazaruzgan, who, you know, we flew in there and the usual Aussie thing, right? We like the Aussie backpacker that comes and sleeps on your couch and eats your food and uses all your hot water. You know, I'm sure they saw us like that. So we tried to do the right thing and brought some Red Bull and milk and whatever else, you know, some fresh supplies in. But we kind of just slept on their couch for a bit. But they were awesome, you know. They gave us their beds and they put up with a bit of a hardship while we were there. So, you know, we totally appreciate that. We always did. But we did our mission and we missed the guy we were looking for. So it was at that sort of period where we couldn't just demand an air asset. It was one of those sort of periods where you're always sort of fighting for those resources. And, you know, one of the things that Australia can't bring to the party sometimes you know, is that organic asset? Not always, but sometimes. And it was certainly one of those times. And so we're kind of stuck up there for a few days. So we got our heads together with the ODA lads and said, okay, what can we do to help out? Came up with a really good plan about how, you know, where they usually get attacked and things. And God bless them, you know, I mean, I love them. But the in all simpleness of the plan, it was, okay, you guys, you Americans, you go out there in your Hummers, Humvees, and basically be the worm on the hook. We got into position overnight, and when the Americans came out in the morning, you know, the bad guys came out to get them, and just like they said they would, and we managed to get the bad guys first. And it was really, really good sort of planning, good execution of you know, using both three forces really, because they had their Afghan guys that they were training up as well. And utilising them as well. So, you know, we were all very excited, and we came back to the FOB and, you know, lots of high fives and bum slaps and things and you know, excitement from grown men and you know, the people that were there, the rest of the people on the base as well. And it sort of led to this other mission where they said, you know, this other valley out to the east, they haven't been able to get up there for quite some time, and they knew there was a pretty serious network of bad guys up there. And we were, you know, we were primarily targeting the leaders of the groups. And we decided to do something similar. The only difference with this valley was, whilst it's quite wide, like it was quite a wide valley, there was only really one way in and one way out back to the FOB. We committed five Humvees and two of our patrols, SAS patrols, of which I was a part of, plus two engineers attached, which made 13 guys, Aussies, jumped on the vehicles with the Americans, and we went up this valley. So we're about 5Ks away from the FOB, between about 5 and 7Ks at the furthest point. And away from that organic support as well, the mortars and things that they had there. And we did a very similar mission where we got off the vehicles and our other guys had humped it overnight into position, into this valley, and pushed all the bad guys up into where the Aussies were hiding and got them. And it was that afternoon we came back and jumped back on the vehicles with the Americans to head back through the valley to get back to the base. And it was sort of late afternoon. We were heading west, so the sun was, you know, sort of beaming straight at us. And we had some indication through the ICOM and whatnot about how they were going to attack us. And it was one of those things. There was no real combat. There was combat indicators, but they're not the sort of really normal large ones. You know, normally you see large masses of women and children leaving and all those sorts of things that give you some really good indications that something's definitely going to kick off. And we'd gone through sort of two points of theirs already where they said, let's ambush them now. And, you know, the commander was coming over the radio saying, no, just wait. And I wouldn't say we got complacent, but, you know, well, the third time that started to happen, we're like, well, are you guys going to have a go or not? As you do over there, right? And I was on the fifth vehicle, the patrol I was with, and we were the last vehicle, and we came over this small rise, and that's when it kind of all erupted on us. So as we're heading west, just trying to give a picture, we were kind of in that weird ground between like a ridge line, and then there's that sloping sort of alluvial plain sort of stuff before it hits the green belt, and that was probably only about 200 meters wide, and we got hit from the green belt to the south, and four different directions initially from what I remember. RPGs coming in, you know, watching them whoosh over your head and that crazy noise they make when they come straight past your head, exploding, hitting some of the vehicles. A couple of the Americans got wounded early. And we did what we trained to do, you know, you fight back. So I jumped off the vehicle myself and I'd organised to use our 84mm Carl Gustav. So I grabbed that and I pushed off to the flanks and started to fire that. I'd run back to the cars, I'd pick up another rocket, load it up, run back out, shoot it off. During that period, one of our brand new guys, he was running rockets out to me as well. And he was a replacement for the guy who got wounded in the IED a few weeks earlier. So this was his third time outside the wire. It's like his third mission ever.
Wow.
I think it speaks volumes for the training that special ops can do. You know, he was the new guy. I didn't know him from a bar of soap, but he was our new guy. So, and we all knew where he came from and what he'd been through to get there. So, you know, you pay him that respect. But he was running rockets out to us as well, and I fired off seven rockets out there off to the flank and ended up just staying out there to fire them off. Funnily enough, when you fire an 84 off and it creates a bit of a percussion and lots of bullets were coming back in our direction. But, you know, it was just that sort of normal combat thing where you just, you know, you're engaging, you're firing back. And this went on for about 20 minutes, this engagement. You know, you're trying to pick targets through the trees. You could see guys moving around here and there. It was very sort of one of those traditional early day contacts where it was a bit, it's really kind of hard to see them and pick out where they were. And especially because it was coming from many different directions, it was very well coordinated. Ended up on this small knoll. Sort of giving us cover to the north, to the south, but our backs are exposed to the north. And I was with the new guy, we're probably 2 or 3 meters apart. And it was one of those moments where you kind of just share a bit of a joke. And I looked across at him and I said, you lucky little bastard. And then he kind of looked back at me and he said, what? And I said, mate, guys will do years in places like this, in units like this, sometimes a whole career to get into something like this. And I said, and here you are, day number three, you're amongst it already. And he looked back at me with his cheeky sort of, he's a real Aussie guy, cheeky little Aussie grin, and just said, it's good, isn't it? And just as we were sort of having a laugh about it all at that moment, and I guess that sort of, that level of, we like to use humour a lot. It's one of our ethoses, and it just helps us keep everything in perspective, I think. But right there and then, about 20, a burst of machine gun fire from the north came from behind us and ripped straight through between us. The bullets were hitting between us. And that's when we kind of went, okay, we've got guys behind us as well now. Everyone started orientating that way and firing up into that ridge line on the north, which is very dominant over that valley. And the JTACs were getting some aircraft in, and we had some fast jets, and they were putting in as much ordnance as they could, but wasn't really stopping these guys that much. It would stop them for the initial engagement, and then they'd just keep cracking at us. We took a few more guys, got clipped a little bit early there, and we eventually jumped back on the vehicles and said, well, let's just, let's punch through this valley. Let's try and get out of here. As we did that, it dwelled a little bit, and we continued to move through the valley, and then it started up again. And the jets had kind of disappeared. They'd gone. The American JTAC was having trouble, and nothing against the guy. It was a very chaotic situation. But he was having trouble getting the air above us. There was a lot of communications issues. It was one of those classic sort of snowball things where, if anything could go wrong, it would go wrong, and it happened right there and then. Our comms, I remember my comms between myself and the Americans was very, very shitty, even though we were only 2 meters apart. The comms back to the other guys, the other Australians that could have supported us with air were non-existent. We couldn't reach the base. So it was sort of one of those things where comms sort of went out. We continued to go through the valley, and I remember being on the back of the vehicle thinking, this is a shit spot to be, because, if I was on the car, that's what I'd, if I was the enemy, that's what I'd shoot at. So I started to run from along the sides of the vehicle and try and use it as cover. Guy popped up really close with an RPG, managed to shoot him, but a couple of us engaged him anyway. So I'm not going to claim that one, but I don't know who got it. But then a couple of other guys popped up and planted a couple of RPGs in front of our vehicle. I remember the smoke and the noise and the rocks and the dust and all those sorts of things coming down. And my patrol commander got hit through the wrist, and he got sort of bailed into the back of the Hummer. Again, not a lot of room in those things, as you guys might know, and certainly the guys that worked with them would know. Not when you've got six extra Aussies who are just hitchhiking a ride as well. We continued to fight, and I remember moving around the vehicles a lot just to sort of use them as cover and jumping up onto the back tray and directing the American guys who were using the 240 Bravos up onto the ridge line, spotting the enemy machine gun pits basically from their from the fire, from the smoke and the dust and stuff coming out of the percussion, kicking up the dust to coming out of their fighting pits to try and direct the gunners onto them. We drove for a bit longer, and then we started to get some pretty serious guys, some serious woundings. And my mate in front of the car, in front of us, he got hit through his right calf, pretty much took off most of his right calf. And he hit the deck. He tried to get back up and move again, fell over again. And then he got shot through his left leg and couldn't walk. He tried to stand up, fell over again. He started crawling after the car. The car was driving away from him, and he's just sort of dragging himself on his elbows, yelling out to the vehicle to stop. They eventually saw him, pulled up the car. One of the Aussies jumped out, dragged him in beside the vehicle to use it as cover. And we used our vehicle on the other side, so to sort of sandwich in between the two cars. At that point, myself and two other guys were moved away from the vehicles, just into the open, into this very, very small scrape. It wasn't really providing anything of cover to the south, but we were trying to pick off targets, and I guess in a conscious decision, we're trying to sort of move the fire away from the vehicle so they could work on him. they threw two tourniquets on his legs. And we had the Americans there. They had the 18 Deltas from the ODA teams who did an awesome job. You know, shout out to those guys because they were amazing. And but I remember lying in this ditch and watched these two Apaches come over for whatever weird reason. There was this sort of reese up at the fob halfway through all this. I remember watching this Chinook come in and these two Apaches, and next thing you know, the Apaches are over the top of us. And I thought, oh, this will be good. You know, this will change the battle. This will help us out a lot, because if we can just get some fire up onto that ridgeline to the north and suppress at least one side of it, you know, that'll give us time to really sort of deal with this situation. And I remember I'm flying around and I was trying to engage the guys I could in the green. And then I watched these two Apaches fly off. And they didn't drop any ordnance and they didn't do anything. And then they just took off, and I watched them fly off through the valley and disappear, like two little black dots. And I remember lying in this ditch just going, fuck, this is what fear is, right? You know, I thought I'd been not so much scared, I guess, in battle before that, but, you know, I'm not sure if this is the valley I'm ever going to come out of, kind of thing. And I thought this is what absolute fear is. I didn't want to move. I wish I had a big metal box just to sit inside, because some of the rounds were starting to come pretty close, as I had already, but even more so. And I had this weird little conversation in my head about, well, fuck, you know, if the Apaches aren't going to do anything, then the only people that are going to get you out of this valley is us. And the only way you're going to do that is if you get up off the ground and start moving. So that's really what got me up out of there that day, I believe, is a quick little conversation about, well, you know, sitting here being scared isn't really going to help you. You know, get up and start moving, because your mates are wounded and they need you to do something. And so I got up and ran around and started helping the guys get the wounded guy in the back of the vehicle. As we started to move, our JTAC had his binoculars shot out, or his laser rangefinder shot out of his hand. And then the next bullet cut under his armpit, ripped through his lung, his stomach, his liver, his spleen, pancreas, his upper intestine, and then came out his left hip. So he was now in a pretty bad way as well. So we've got one guy that's, you know, potential femoral artery hemorrhaging, you know, and everything else in his legs, and now we've got another guy who's just been shot through the chest. Extremely bad. Again, we stopped. The 18 Deltas did an amazing job of putting a hole in him and putting a seal in his chest, and we just had to put him back in the Hummers because the air meds weren't going to come, the AMEs weren't going to come and risk a frame picking us up. Still lots of gunfire going on at this stage. So we remember we chucked him in the front of the vehicle and, you know, all puns aside, someone said, you're just going to have to suck it up. And we continued fighting, and it got kind of strange at this point. Like there was this little sort of ditch, and some rockets really started coming in, and then I remember the car in front of me just disappeared in this sort of big hail of dust and rocks and explosions, and rockets were just pounding it. And then two of the guys, one was American, one was an Aussie. Two Aussies got wounded during that. But one of the Aussies in particular, he crawled underneath the vehicle to try and get some cover, and then the vehicle took off and he was trying to hang on to the axle underneath it to get just getting dragged along by the vehicle, trying to use it as cover, and then he couldn't hang on and it got sped out the back. The American guy jumped on the vehicle. They'd both been shot. So he started running after it, and, you know, we were behind it watching this, and I was engaging the enemy. I could see, or for where I thought they were. And he eventually made his way to the front of the car and jumped on the Hummer. And his gun had been shot, so his gun was useless. He'd been shot through the hip and through his ankle. And he kind of, I remember talking to him, and he said he thought to himself, well, you know, I could take a few more to the body, but if I cop one in the head, I'm no good. So he jumped on the front of the car and wrapped the chain, you know, the tow chain around his head, and continued to do what he could from there, which was just get on the radio and try and coordinate things. And we continued to fight, and we got to another spot through the valley where we're just, you know, sort of on one side of the car, a couple of seconds breather. You'd run around the other side of the car just getting chased by bullets. And there was myself, the young guy, the brand new guy, and then my 2IC. And we sort of stuck together doing this the whole time. And then we got to a point where the cars were getting smashed again by rockets. And I remember having a quick conversation with the 2IC saying, this is mental. You know, those two cars have gone through that one spot getting hammered. They've got it dialed in. You know, that's it's they've ranged it already. They know exactly where they're going to shoot these things. And I said, I'm going to run through first. And he said, yeah, okay, I'll come with you. So we took off. We punched out in front of the vehicle on foot and try and draw the fire away from the wounded guys in the car. We ran through that spot. I remember the bullets coming in. I remember the rockets, like hearing them come across and hearing them being, you know, the thud at the other end of, obviously them leaving the units. And we slid in behind this rock that was, I don't know, maybe the size of a washing machine. And I slid in first and then he slid in and it kind of knocked me out one side. And then I jumped back in behind it and pushed him back out the other way. And, yeah, we were sort of having a little cuddle behind the rock. But, yeah, I remember looking back though and the car that we were sort of fighting alongside went through unscathed. And it was just enough to sort of take that, you know, to put enough doubt in the enemy's mind about who do we shoot? Did we shoot the guy running in front of the car or do we shoot the car itself? And it, you know, they had a crack at us. And by the time we, you know, they missed us and then they missed the car as well, which was good. Then we had to make a dash back to the vehicle and we did so. And this continued on and on, you know, just fighting around and around the cars, trying to get some momentum, trying to get moving. Unfortunately, the guys driving the first car, they decided to stop and just close all the hatches. These were the Afghan guys. The ADA dudes are trained up and you know they just decided to go hold down and not move. And we didn't really want a mobility kill because that was just going to stop us all together. So one of the Aussies ran forward and pulled the driver out and jumped in the car and started to drive it himself. Excuse me. And then we just continued to fight alongside the cars. It got to a point where the car in front of us got smashed by RPGs and two guys got blown out of the back of it from what I remember. And one was an Afghan engineer, an Afghan interpreter. The other was an Aussie engineer. And he had a dog as well. And that's when the dog took off into the village. That was the last time it was seen. But he got up and started to move. But the Afghan guy was laying face down. In a pool of blood, not moving, and we'd kind of offset from this and the car that I was fighting alongside. And I said to my mate, you know, I'm going to go out there and get him. We had a quick discussion, and then I just took off. And I just remember looking at him thinking, you know, I know I can get to this bloke. No one wants to be left behind in a battle, you know. It'd be the worst place to be, I think. So I got out to him, started to drag him. He was unconscious, blood all over his face. You know, I'm not a big guy, so I started to drag him through the dirt. It wasn't really working out for me. So I got him up to his feet and you know, bullets were coming in around us everywhere. Feeling brushing past my pants and stuff. Got him up to his feet, got my arm underneath him and sort of started to half carry, half drag him. He was a bit taller than me. Just started to sort of run back towards the car and it was driving away from us. I was trying to weigh up all the options, you know. I just remember thinking, do I just leave this guy there? Do I use him as a shield or do I just try and get him back to the car? And, you know, I just thought, well, the best place to be is back on the vehicle for this bloke. You know, he's got some pretty serious wounds by the looks of it. Let's get him back. And that's all I sort of really focused on was the back of that vehicle and just ran as hard as I could till I got there. Managed to eventually get to the vehicle. I was pretty dry by that stage. And it's kind of hard to open a Hummer when you're holding a bloke, holding your gun, and open the car door of the Hummer whilst it's moving as well. So it took me a little while to actually get him in the back of the car and wrap a bandage around his head and kind of, you know, that was the best medical aid I could really give at the time. As I came to the back of the car, my young mate, the young guy, it was his third job ever, was at the back of the vehicle and he'd been fighting and he had blood all down his face and during this sort of process. And I said, mate, what happened to you? And he said, I've been shot. And I said, yeah, no fucking shit. He shot through the head. But he was alive, it just grazed his skull. So he had an in and out through his head, but it didn't actually penetrate his skull. So it just grazed it. But we eventually were at full sprint. We finally got onto the back of the vehicle and to fight from there. The cars were just taken off at this stage. And when we climbed into the back, there was a wounded American. The gun on the back wasn't going. There was an Aussie in the turret, but the gun on the back wasn't working. There's a wounded American and wounded Afghan had been shot through the face. Another wounded Aussie been shot through the leg and through the hand. He wasn't fighting either. And then regrettably, there was a dead American, one of the engineer guys. He was a dog handler that they had as a detachment. And Sergeant Rodriguez. And unfortunately, he was dead. So we continued to fight from the back of the vehicle. And I remember the rounds were coming in that hot that, you know, I started looking for – I don't really talk about this a lot, to be honest. Started looking for options about, you know, I could take a couple in the body. It's come pretty close already. You know, over the 50% of our force had been hit. I don't really want to take one in the head. So made a tough decision to take the helmet off the dead American. And he'd been killed and he'd been shot through the head. So it wasn't very pretty. But put his helmet on and then continued to grab the machine gun, the 240 Bravo on the back, and then start using that. Makes you feel pretty good using a machine gun in a battle like that after you've been using your little pea shooter trying to shoot out to some distance on the move. But started to use that. It stopped. Went through the stoppage drill, and then when I went to reach around the front of it to change the gas setting on it, it had a bullet strike straight through the gas setting. So that was all peeled open and useless. So then we lost the use of that machine gun. Didn't know where the spare barrel was at that stage. So just grabbed my gun and we just continued to fight out of the back of the vehicles. We eventually made it back to the base. And when we got there, like I said, about 50% of the force was wounded. So, you know, they were talking about overrunning the base. We're getting smashed from both sides. So I went for about 3.5 hours, roughly. I mean, I didn't hit the stopwatch, but, yeah, 3.5 hours from sort of first bullets to last bullets. And it was just after that initial sort of lull, after that initial battle, it was just really consistent, you know, gunfire and rockets. I've never really experienced consistency like that up until that point anyway. And certainly, to be honest, I hadn't really experienced it since, not consistently like that. So anytime you're on one side of the vehicle, you're getting shot at, so... it was about 4 kilometres long from start to finish, from sort of first bullets to last bullets. So, when we got back to the FOB, started working on all the wounded guys and you know, prioritising, and as you would know, Chantel, what that's like, right? So, yeah. And then it was well into the night by the time we sort of – it took 3 aeromedical evacuations on a roughly sort of 60-80-minute turnaround to get the guys out. So, you know, he's trying to stabilise some blokes and – the priorities being the, you know, the good guys and then the bad guys. So, well, not the bad guys, sorry, but the good guys and then the, you know, the guys that aren't as critical, I guess. The last helicopter lift out, once we dragged all the ammo off, the last guy I put on there was the Afghan guy I went and picked up, and that was the last time I saw him. So, I don't know whether I didn't know whether he lived or not. I heard he had, but I don't know. He was a local from what I know. So I don't know whether he went back up there and went home or what he did. But that was kind of the battle, I suppose.
But, you know, with all of that you're saying, Mark, the one thing that you don't say and that I know that's going to – would have been a huge, like, factor that people couldn't even imagine, aside of all of that really vivid thing that you're talking about, is the heat. Mm. I mean – the way that you're saying that you were cutting around as and other people for that prolonged attack, and that's to me is just, that's fucking incredible. I mean, because you've not even taken it's quite hard to, I guess, unless you're there, even if you could describe it every single day of the week, but it would still be impossible to describe just how hard going that was.
Yeah, I remember running out of water early during the battle too.
It's almost like we were describing earlier, when things, you know, when it rains, it pours.
Yeah, exactly.
in that day, you know, and even the sort of you just describing that moment that you don't talk about the helmet, that's the reality of war. To try and even in the best books, the book that you've written yourself, and all of those other things, it's still extremely hard to explain. Like I can even now, I can imagine your dry mouth. I can imagine the way that, you know, the way that you just the thinking about you sort of lying in those ditches in your own little world, coming up with those ideas is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's why you do all that work.
But you say that, and you're going to be really humble about it now, and I know exactly what you. But not everyone can do that. That's not in everybody. And it is.
That's why there's a process, I suppose. But yeah, that's all. I appreciate where you're getting at, it's really hard.
It's weird. It's hard to say it about yourself, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't say it about you? I get that.
Yeah, but I mean, you're right. Though it's you know, the conditions. There's a firefight anywhere, right? Nowhere's ideal for a firefight, I guess, unless you're on some sort of lush paddock, and even then it's going to suck, right? So,
yeah.
But the fact that it's hot and it's dry, and you know, it adds an element to everything.
And it's almost like it's the last place that you want to die. And I know that sounds like a strange thing to say, but yeah, it's almost like it's hot.
Well, I mean,
it's just one of those things. Yeah.
For sure, you know, I mean, that's one of the thoughts I had there. It was like, the only way we can get out of this is if we do it ourselves, and I don't really want to die in this valley,
And that's like, why I say the last when I said the point I made at the beginning of the podcast is that it's no accident that you ended up where you were. You know, with the processes you went through, as a kid. With your mum and your father died, you know, he died too early as well. But those different processes, it's no accident that you ended up there, and it's an amazing story.
Oh, thank you. I just think for me, one of the biggest things about that whole day was it was never about the medals and all those sorts of things. And, you know, we were in a really bad situation.
Yeah,
and you know, I'm trying to retell something that was 3.5 hours long in a couple of minutes, with as much detail as I could possibly give. There were so many other people that did great things there that day, and that for me, that's always really important. You know, whether it was the Americans, the Afghans, or the Aussies, everyone's going to have an opinion about it, and that's fine, but we lived it. You know, we had to fight it that day.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, we came back, we got everyone back, and that we could. And you know, the very next day we were out on another mission. And there's a photo that was taken just before we left the FOB. Now, I think it was another day later, or that next day, sorry, of kind of the guys that were left from that day and the dudes that had still been wounded as well that were not so critical. But I kind of look at that and I go, you know, for me, that's what I'm most proud about that day, and it's not so much the medal and the ribbon and all that, which is, you know, sort of followed on a few months later. But it was the fact that we did it anyway, and we would have done it anyway, whether we got the accolade and anyone heard about it or they didn't. And that for me is what's most important, is that we did it for each other, and the situation that we found ourselves in, and that's what it all comes down to, not the other stuff.
Well, and it goes again back to the great wars of that process, or that point in time, you were part of something that's just as special, is something that was, you know, part of maybe your ancestors in the great wars. Do you know what I mean? It was that sort of thing that's in history.
Yeah, exactly.
And as we speak about those places in Europe, the places where all of the great warriors fell, again, people will speak about that and in hundreds of years to come. You know, it's
Yeah, it's true. And it's
really humbling to listen to. That's why I'm probably short on words. John, are you still awake?
Yeah. No, and you know, listening to it,
it's hard, isn't it?
What it does is, like, when you're reading a book, you have like a mental picture of what you think it looks like, you know. And as he's telling the story, I'm like visualizing it, and as usual, it probably doesn't look like it. Probably didn't look like what I would imagine it looks like, you know, just from listening to it. But you know,
you can't. It's the smell and things. It's the smell, the heat, and
right.
Even the smell from the vehicle fuel, it's all of it, isn't it?
Right, and you know, having sweat in your eyes and you're trying to focus and, you know, you could hear the rounds cracking by your head. I mean, those small details really make the difference in the experience. And I'm just trying to imagine some of those smaller details as he's telling the story, you know. But, you know, when you talk about things like adding the heat factor to it, you know, it must be an exhausting process, you know, like you're sitting there, you're trying to think while all this is going on. And this is part of where, you know, we're talking about that mindset and how do you overcome obstacles in a tough situation or, you know, one of your mates gets shot and the situation is looking even more bleak than before. How do you come out of that? You know, it's that mindset that you spent all these years training for. That kind of gets you to that point, yeah. You know, the walking without the iPod in your ears, you know,
that demoralizing moment with the Apache. I think that was really telling.
Yeah. Obstacle force. You're sitting there and you're like, fuck, like these dudes just left, you know?
Well, cause you pray for the Apache. It's like, as soon as you know that an ugly call sign's on station, it's like, sweet. Everyone's waiting for it. And it's then,
you talk about things changing a battle. I mean, those things change a battle.
Yeah.
And it's simple as that. And the fact that we'd lost the air assets altogether was a real sort of thing in that day. If we'd managed to have them and we didn't lose, you know, our JTAC and the other JTAC didn't have the issues he had and then also get clipped, you know, just the fact that they didn't get the CAS that we could have, we would hope to have had. On any other given day, you know, probably one of the things about that day was that sort of, you know, turned it into a, I don't know, it might sound silly, but it turned into a true gunfight, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And then you've got the older heat seeker, your little buddy. How's he getting along?
Yeah, he's all right. He's good.
There's a baptism of fire.
I'm not getting shot in the head today, right? But,
no, but is he okay? And I'm not joking. Is he okay? Obviously, physically.
He's loving life because his beloved Richmond Tigers, who are a football team here in Australia, won the grand final.
Right, there you go.
Premiership, right? So he's excited.
Does he like Tim Tams all around?
Well, probably VBs more than anything. But
I still can't get my head around those. I remember someone saying, have a Tim Tam. So this is a fucking penguin. Because obviously that's what we call them in the UK. It's a penguin. Yeah. You say, no, it's a Tim Tam. And then, they are slightly different. I'll give you that. Same, but different.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it's I think that that day, you know, you talk about those little things and it's the sound that they make. You know, that a bullet makes when it slaps the side of the car or when the rocket explodes just in front of you, and then it's that sort of silence, and then there's all the noise from the rocks and the things. You know, I remember funny little things like one stage everything just sort of went, like I got tunnel vision and everything was really, really loud and all I could hear was this deep thump. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, shit, have I been shot or, you know, am I just in overwhelm? What's going on?
Yeah.
And then I realized that the 50 cal was 1 foot above my head, you know, from the turret on the Hummer and one of the Americans was shooting the 50 cal right above my head and that's what it was. You know, it was just my body getting smashed from the 50 cal, my head getting smashed from it. And then I remember running outside that car and watching a magazine, you know, an empty magazine fall out of my pocket and just little tiny things like that, right? So
yeah.
It's funny.
And that's the thing. People don't realise that those little things, I mean, like say the 50 cal, for instance, if someone's ears go, you know, and then all of a sudden their balance is gone. That they're out of the firefight. You know, people people don't realize that it's very. It doesn't take a lot to take people out.
No, exactly. You know what I'm saying? Exactly.
And you can become quite like ineffective really quickly. So those little things that we just don't. The detail that you don't even think about, it's crazy, isn't it?
And it's just like you're in that moment, right? So you say, like, we're all sitting here, you know, in our homes or whatever, talking about this, and then you say something like, yeah, I didn't even realize the 50 cal above me was just busting off. And it's like to be at a point where you don't realize that a 50 caliber machine gun is firing right above your head. You know, it's kind of crazy. Like if I hear something drop in my room, I'm like, oh, you know, what's going on? But it's just kind of that, you know,
it's like you're in the zone.
That moment, right? Yeah. You know.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I don't know. Maybe in America, you've got the chance to go and do it, but go and stick your head next to a 50 cal barrel right at the front. It's not fun, right? So, well, it is for a couple of seconds, but after that, it's not so good. But it's just one of those strange things that. I don't know, all those little things in the battle, but that sort of make it what it is. But, for me, it was a couple of months later before I got told about, the Victoria Cross and stuff. But,
what did you, like, because that's, it doesn't get any higher than that. And it's almost, and like we discussed before we actually started the podcast, you have to have, you're at least in the 90% chance of death.
Alive
is huge,
isn't it? Yeah, I mean, if you look at that, I mean, if you want to sort of break it down, it's that signal act, and I say it in an Australian accent to try and, if people want to Google it, read it, look it up.
Yeah, look it up.
A whole sort of bunch of definitions, really, that sort of go into it. But one of the main things is it has to have three eyewitness accounts. And, for me, the fact that the guys who were there that day who saw it decided it was worth something was enough for me. But it was a weird thing, it was a strange thing being told that that's what you're going to get. And,
Did you feel awkward, like going – I know that sounds like a really stupid 100%. Question, but because it's I'm not saying it's embarrassing because clearly what you did is not embarrassing, but just – If you're a soldier, if you're a special ops like you are, you're quite humble. So you're kind of there you are, and you're getting this victory. How did you feel? Did you?
Yeah, 100% felt. To be honest, 100% felt unworthy, and there's an element of me that's comfortable with the fact that I have it now, but I still feel unworthy of it, and I went and brought a book. Was like, so, I mean, at the start, before we started, got into this, I didn't even know what one was. I got told about it and rung up and said, hey, can you come and see the commanding officer and the chief of the army next week? Oh, sorry, in 2 days' time at a cafe in Perth.
No biggie?
Yeah, and I'm going, well, that's a bit weird because, Trooper Donaldson, for example, doesn't normally get rung up by commander of special ops to say, can you come and have a meeting with the chief of the CO and the chief of the army? So it's kind of like, either I've really fucked up really bad and I don't even know it, or this is about something else, right? So we got there and they handed me the bit of paper, and to kind of paint the picture, I suppose, is it's a bit weird sitting in a cafe getting passed a bit of paper, and they'd done it in a sort of traditional way where they'd emptied out and booked half the cafe, so it was all sort of closed off to public, and there was just this empty space and this one desk right at the far end of the cafe with two guys.
Could you make it a bit more awkward? That's like
yeah, I was like, well, could have just done this in my house, but that's cool, or at work even, but that's all right. This will do. And
it's such a typical Aussie sort of attitude as well.
But we sat down and they slid the paper across and it said what it said. And look, to be honest, first thing I said to my CEO was, what does this mean with work? And that was my first question was,
oh, wow.
What's going to happen to my job? Because I'm in the regiment and, I didn't join up to not do it. So, you know, luckily enough, they were sensational people and sensational leadership to be able to say, you know, we're happy to tackle those bridges when they come, and you know, there might certain things that might change, but you know, all in all, you'll still be, you know, the soldier we trained you and wanted you to be, so or need you to be, I guess. And that was kind of refreshing to hear, you know what I mean? Yeah. And after that, we went and had a beer. So that was kind of the next most logical step, really, because it was after midday. That's what you do, right? So,
yeah.
But it was a bit bizarre because in a week later, you know, I was in the government house and the Queen's representative, being the Governor General, Quinton Bryce, was pinning it on my chest, and the Chief of Defence Force was saluting me. You know, which is a big deal, I guess, in the sense that, you know, the highest ranking officer salutes. At that time, I was the lowest ranking you could possibly get. So, you know, that was a pretty big deal for the nation.
Yeah, no, it's huge. I mean, and you've had like, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, are there three, have there been three recipients from the SASR? As in,
There's been two. Late? Two, yeah, so there's another, Ben Robert Smith, a mate of mine, he got one as well a couple of years later.
Yeah.
And then there's also been one from the other unit within the Special Ops community here, 2 Commando Regiment. So he also got one. So it's
And that was that Cameron Baird? Yeah. He was killed, wasn't he?
Yeah, Cameron Baird. So he's his posh. So. And then one other from the battalions for the Afghanistan campaign, Dan Kieran. So, you know, I mean, I guess you kind of look at it and go, geez, that's quite a few, but.
But they're all different. And I've obviously looked at all, they're all very different. And I think it goes to show, you know, the Aussies, especially from the guys that I've known as well that have served in Afghanistan, that the roles that everyone had in their own little areas of operations were very different, but you know, equally hard in these sort of areas, because it's no joke. You know, this isn't, a lot of people sort of romanticize these things, and I think that even that story that you've just shared with the Zen, clearly that's not a romantic story.
No, and it kind of comes back to what you're saying about did it feel awkward and weird, and you know, I went to the War Memorial before. Silly story, but one of the things that's changed for me now is if I go to the War Memorial here in Australia, which is a big, it's a huge, amazing place to go and sort of remember our.
It looks beautiful as well, by the way, that place.
Yeah, our military is, it's fantastic. And, but, you know, I go there now and it's kind of hard for me to kind of just be the person who's visiting, which is great. You know, I love talking to the staff and things, but I went there 2 days before actually being awarded the VC and looked at all the, there's upwards of, I think there's 60 odd VCs in there now, and reading their stories and just thought, you know, how weird is it that mine will probably be there very soon.
Exactly. So, and again, it's that thing where we spoke about, you know, even the fact you joined the unit that you did, your early life, you know, that's inspiring enough. And then, if I could describe a VC as an added bonus, I mean, Jesus, it's crazy. Yeah, that's the stuff before that was almost enough. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I do.
And that's
hey guys, can I take a 2 second break?
Yeah, sure.
Sorry. I'll just give me 1 minute. I'll be back in a sec.
Yeah, you're good.
Sorry.
Yeah, I was gonna say I knew it was serious once he was talking about going on long hikes with no iPod. I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That's fucking Bruce Lee shit right there.
I know. Because that's really like, that's hard. It's really focused, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because there was a time where I was doing a lot of cardio and I was able to run a decent amount of, a decent distance.
Yeah.
And when I was at the top of my game, as far as running, I would probably run like the first 4 or 5 miles and not listen to anything. I would have my earphones with me, but I wouldn't actually turn it on. And I felt like it kind of took away from my ability to keep running and stay focused. So when he was talking about that, it just kind of brought me back to that point. Like I kind of understood it to an extent, you know.
See, whereas I have my I always have the tunes that get me up hills that I have to put on.
Mm.
But yeah, when you went away there, Mark, we were just discussing how. In fact, how did you word it? It was just.
Oh no! That, I said that I knew
hardcore
it was like
kind of.
Yeah, like I knew it was like when he said that he was doing all this long, you know, exercises without any earphones. That's when I'm like, all right, this is serious shit. You know,
this guy's serious shit. Yeah. Is what John just said.
Right. And then, you know, I was just thinking like I was just telling Chantel there was a point where I was able to run a decent distance. You know, I used to run like kind of long distance. And I would run, when I was at the top of my game, I would run the first couple of miles without any music. And I felt like listening to the music kind of took away from my ability to focus. And, you know, when I made the comment about listening to your feet hit the pavement, that's what I used to do. I used to just listen to my feet hit the floor, and it kind of kept me in focus, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It's and you get into kind of like a weird rhythm, right? Because
yeah,
we're humans, like patterns. So we create patterns even sometimes to I guess almost harmonize us, or that's a stupid way to put it, but
no, actually that makes sense, and you kind of everything kind of is in harmony. I guess that's
what
you describe it.
Yeah, that's how you. That's stuff,
but I just wanted to come back to just that day in the VC just really quickly. I just had to sort out something with the kids. Sorry, but. Do an argument over who knows what, but I just think with those, we're talking a lot about, you know, the bonus or not the bonus, but the you know, you go through your career and then you get an award such as that, or I guess the MOH, the Medal of Honor for the guys in America is, I guess one of the things is just really I wanted to highlight probably for the listeners is, for me, you know, I remember that day very differently to how people probably perceive it because of the VC. But something I'm very, very conscious of is the fact that, you know, that's turned out to be sometimes a good thing for me. It is certainly a day which, for some of those guys that were there, you know, it was potentially and certainly the worst day of their life up until that point. And my mates who got through their legs, he's made an amazing recovery, but he'll never walk again properly, right? And there's going to be certain things that, because of that day, his life will have changed forever. And certainly my other mates that were, you know, shot and wounded, and the American guys, and you know, again, rest in peace, Sergeant Rodriguez, and his family. You know, that day is very different for them, and to a degree for my wife, that day is very different. You know, so I really like to try and just keep it in perspective because. And she sees that day very differently. That was the day that I nearly didn't come home. And I knew I was nearly dead in a valley in Afghanistan somewhere, right? So, you know, like you were talking about before, you know, people like to romanticize things. I think it's important to keep those points that, you know, it's certainly from a different perspective.
Right.
Even though we're in place at the same time. Right. Can certainly turn out people, right?
Yeah, and talking to different guys who have been awarded, you know, for actions in combat or in a really bad situation, a lot of times what I've been told, like off air or on air, is like, you know, kind of retelling these stories is really me or this other guy for him, you know, he's told me off air, is, you know, that's him reliving the worst day of his life, you know, because now he's wounded and it's affected him, you know, in a negative way. In regards to like he can't walk the same or you know, for the family of a guy who was killed, you know what I mean? So it's I'm glad you brought that up because it's just kind of adding perspective. Like when you read these books or, you know, a situation where maybe a movie was made, it's all cool and like, you know, the gunfight and it's, you know, it's badass and everything, but the reality is people's lives do get changed from these events, for good or for worse, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's that famous, it's the ripple effect, isn't it? And the ripples, you know, as we know today with the issues that guys and girls are having, there's, you know, they go far and wide. So it is important to understand how, you know, what this actually means, and, you know, and actually what Victoria Cross is. It is an award, but, you know, you've had to do some stuff to get that award, and some stuff's had to happen on that day that's not been, you know, not been the best outcome for a lot of people. Yeah, it's a really good point to bring up.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of reality.
Yeah.
There's a lot of truth, probably a better way to put it, not reality, because reality is just perception of what we think it is. But
I have a feeling, though, Mark, this isn't the end for you. What are you going to charge into next?
That's a good question, Chantel. It's I've got a few things I'm looking at the moment, so it's just a matter of figuring out which one to take and what option to take. And look, I think I'll probably use a similar approach, and certainly some of the things that I've learned in my special ops time is the planning process and all those good things that you learn in there around principles and whatnot. But first and foremost, just start doing something, and that will lead to, you know, inspiration, motivation, discipline, commitment. You know, but you know, have an idea, have a plan, but you got to start doing it.
And it'd be quite nice for you to submit. Are you going to take a bit of a break, like a family break? And
I've taken a bit of a break now, so it's now under. Well, I've got a little surf trip with some mates organised. Which I've got to get that out of the way, but then it's sort of into it from there, hopefully.
I'm half expected you to say, I've had a week off. I'm all good. I'm all there.
Like John was saying, it's a mindset thing, right? So what I've experienced with guys, certainly here in Australia and in the SF community, is what I kind of understand now is I feel like I'm still a part of it and always will be.
But that's not going to go away.
Decided to move out of home, right? And that's kind of how it feels. And what's familiar and what I'm used to, and the guys I'm used to talking with and how we talk and the things we talk about. I'm stepping into a space that's very different now. But I really just got to keep in mind, you know, why am I doing it? And is it for growth or what's at the end of it all? For me, it has to really be about a challenge and that next thing. I think, like for a lot of guys, the hardest thing will be that really do love this job or that job, which I do and I did, is seeing the guys go away and do something else. And that's going to be the biggest test, I think, especially if you're still young enough and fit enough, mind and soul and body, to sort of get back into it if that was ever the case. But for me, it's about, you know, really looking at what's next, what's good for the family, and where those values lie. You know, what do I value most? And I was talking to a mate yesterday about it. He goes, "Well, who's getting the best of you?" We kind of spoke a little bit about that. About, well, it's really easy these days to come home from work and go, "I'm just going to be effort, you know, not putting any effort with the family, because I'm tired and I just want to sit down and do nothing." And you kind of go, "Well, hang on a minute, who's getting the best of me? Is it the people that matter, or is it, you know what I mean? Or is it the place that you're just pouring everything into for no real result other than a bit of cash to do something?" It's really sort of all based around those things. Yeah.
And it's you've got, you know, that transition period, it kind of, and just from experience, you know, it takes time, and you've got to allow yourself and kind of, I don't want to sound, you know, too sort of flowery, but you've got to be quite kind to yourself, you know, give yourself some time, because it's not easy, regardless of, because you've been at such a pinnacle that, you know, that transition period is still going to take some time, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's, you know, I think certainly for, yeah, anything, if I could give you any piece of advice, especially the guys leaving a soft sort of career, is go and do something that you're going to fail at. And I guess what I mean by that is try and choose something that you're not going to be really good at, or that you're not – it's one of those things, right, when you're in there, and it's even in the normal military, you kind of get used to achieving things, get used to doing things. Yeah. And you train to – you make mistakes and et cetera, but you kind of get used to winning, if that makes sense. Yeah. Not so much on the actual battlefield, but you know, in general sort of day-to-day stuff. So I think it's good to go and remind ourselves that, hey, we do fail at shit. And because then if you do get out there in the real world and it doesn't work out, it's not going to crush everything. You're not going to sort of fall apart and go, fuck, this is the first time I've failed something in my life. All right. So how do I deal with that? And I think generally most guys are pretty good, right? They're used to just getting on with it once they fail something. But it's different when you're in the military to when you're out, I believe. And just going and doing something that you just go, actually, you know what, I'm actually really shit at this. And then working on that, right? I think that goes a long way to sort of, again, that mindset thing about, hey, let's just do some stuff and move forward.
Yeah, I accept. No, that this has been, you know, it's been a real sort of a real treat to hear you talk about your own story, because again it's very different to read about it than to hear from the person that's actually been there. So
thank you.
Obviously, I appreciate hearing.
Yeah, if I had better ways of showing and explaining it, sure, it might help. But that's as good as we get, I guess, these days. And I think it's important that. Thanks to you guys for being able to put these sorts of things out there so people can access them.
People love it. I think people are really going to enjoy, you know, just hear it, because it's it's straight from the horse's mouth. It's really cool. It's a really cool, even the stuff that you share that potentially is not always easy to share, people appreciate that honesty, and they appreciate it. It's almost like, you know, you're talking from the heart, and that I think that goes a long way.
Yeah, and what's the name of your book for anyone who's listening? They want to pick it up and get their hands on a copy.
Yeah, it's called The Crossroad. Not very clever, but we'll play on words. It's called The Crossroad. So, at this stage, it's only available in Australia and New Zealand. You can get a hold of it. If you talk to the publishing company, Penn Macmillan in Australia, they'll be able to get you some direct, but I believe. And there is other ways on the internet to get a hold of it.
Is it going to come out on Kindle? I did see it's not.
Yeah, I think you need to order it through the Australian system stage. And I just haven't released it internationally just yet.
They should. I mean, it's a story.
Yeah, that was my call, actually.
Oh, right, okay. So,
yeah. At this stage, I haven't released it internationally because there's talk of making it into a movie. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so.
Right, so we'll keep that under wraps.
Well, yeah, I'm still trying to figure that bit out.
Who's going to play you?
Brad Pitt. No, I don't know.
Is he not a bit old?
Someone short, ugly with red hair. There's not many of those in Hollywood, right?
I thought that dude, the guy who played, he was actually in Lone Survivor. He was like my favorite character. The dude, he just kept killing people. Do you remember?
Yeah, he was cool.
His character, the way he portrayed it, I thought was, you know, probably my favorite character. He was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, they did both. Haven't figured it all out yet, but we're working on it. So.
Oh wow, that's brilliant! Well, that's brilliant news.
Yeah, well, it's I don't know. I'm not 100% sold just yet, but we'll figure it out.
Oh, cool.
All right, awesome. So, you know, Mark, I just want to thank you for taking out the time to do this. You know, we really appreciate it. I know the audience is definitely going to appreciate it. Especially the young Australians who are looking to join the military or to kind of take that next step and go into the one of those specialized units.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for your time, John and Chantel. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been great.
Yeah, if there's anything I could say, it's certainly that there's a whole bunch of stories out there, and you know, I guess I'm lucky enough to have mine brought into public eye, I suppose. But yeah, if you certainly want to challenge yourself, and certainly over the last 15 years, I know Australian Special Ops community has been doing a lot of work and a lot of good work. And regardless of the things that get out there about, you know, what people believe and whatnot, you know, they're good people doing good things, and that's kind of what it really matters and being a part of. And it's if it's a challenge that you think you're up for, then there's only one way to find out, right? You can do all the reading and all the research you like, but you still got to go and do it, and that's what it all comes down to.
So get your headphones off, get your music off, yeah, and get out of there.
Yeah,
throw some bricks in your backpack and just fucking walk.
Yeah, buddy, yes, exactly right. Go and annoy the shit out of yourself, right? And keep lying to yourself to keep going. That's about all it is.
Yeah.
Nah, that's all
right. Give your family our best and keep safe as always.
Yeah, thank you. You guys too. It's I was actually going to try and catch up with you, Chantel. I was in the UK about 2 weeks ago.
Oh wow, that's
yeah,
great. Telling me now.
I know. I was going to reach out, and then I thought, oh no, I'll just leave. I was there for the DCI.
Oh really?
But, yeah.
Well, if you and your family are ever, please let me know. That'd be great.
No, we're coming over next year for the. They do that. I don't know if you know, but the BCGC thing in England. They do a reunion every 2 years, so and they get all nine of us VCs, and then all. Actually, there's 10 now because of Leaky, because of Josh. But,
yeah, no, he's thrown one in there, hasn't he, the old paratrooper? Yeah,
no,
he's brilliant.
And then and the rest of the GCs, but they get us all together every 2 years. So.
Yeah, that's fab. It'd be good actually, because I'm an ambassador for our National Army Museum, so it'd be good to if ever you're about, you know, I'll take you and the family in, because if you've got kids, it's all interactive now, so they can do all crazy stuff, and it's quite a decent day out.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Actually, I think one of the cool things, John, I'd actually like to see, and I don't know who's going to organise it, but maybe it might have to be me, but to get all the VCs and the Medal of Honor recipients in one room, I reckon that'd be that'd be pretty cool one day to maybe try and do that. But it's
I got a friend of mine who's a Medal of Honor winner. Actually, he's going to be on the podcast in a couple of weeks, but he's probably the right guy to talk to, I guess. So I could mention it to him and see, you know, because I know there's like processes, and at least, you know, over here when you win the Medal of Honor, you have to there's certain like responsibilities or things that's expected of you. And, yeah. You know, you kind of talk on behalf of the Army or the Marine Corps or whatever it is, and that kind of thing. But yeah, they're all connected, because there's events where I've seen like Medal of Honor recipients from Vietnam with Medal of Honor recipients from Afghanistan, Iraq. So I'll definitely talk to him about it. And, you know, that would be pretty cool to have something organized like that.
And I'm pretty sure that you could get people to make that happen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, especially if it was for, coming together for something in particular, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
Sure. All right. Cool. Appreciate your time, guys. Very much.
All right, cool. Thanks.
All right. Cheers. See ya.
That wraps it up for our conversation with Victoria Cross recipient and SAS trooper Mark Donaldson. We hope you guys enjoyed it. Mark will be on in the future, and we're going to talk about a couple different things, as he's had a very long career serving in special operations and working through different specialties within the unit. So as always, we encourage you guys to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, download the episodes, share them with your friends and family, and leave us a rating, leave us a review, and that way we can get your feedback and we know what we need to improve on or what we need to continue doing so that you guys will enjoy this podcast on a weekly basis. My website is www.globalrecon.net. My Instagram account is IGRecon. The second account is Black Ops Matter. Chantel Taylor, my co-host, is the author of a book called Battle Worn, The Memoirs of a Combat Medic in Afghanistan. Check it out. It's available
on Amazon. It's probably the easiest place to get it. She's on Facebook at Battle Worn, the Memoirs of a Combat Medic in Afghanistan. Her Instagram account is mission_critical. Check her out there. I'm on Twitter at IG Recon. I'm also on LinkedIn. Just search Global Recon. We'll see you guys in a couple of days with another episode. Peace.